So since we resumed in early January, we've been going through this set of subjects that the Buddha would often teach on before he gave the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the teaching on suffering and how to be released from suffering. These are, you can think of these as kind of like the prereqs, or, you know, this is sort of like basic arithmetic where to the more complex geometry of the further path. I don't know if that's the best metaphor. These are teachings that often he would give to lay people who were not yet devotees, not yet believers in the system. So you come in off the street, the Buddha has the power of sensing the state of your mind, like how confused or unconfused you are, which makes one a little bit nervous. It made his opponents in debate nervous. There's these texts where a student of a different teacher goes to his different teacher and says, I'm going to go debate Gotama the Buddha. And the teacher's like, don't do it. You know, he'll convert you. And it always happens in the Buddhist texts. It always happens that he converts the debater because he's so good at his thing. So the process of debating and kind of convincing a new person often started with these topics. And the topics are giving or generosity, ethics, wise action, not causing harm. That's the first two. So the basis really is generosity as, in a sense, the first quality. Like the whole path is built on turning away from greed and acquisition and clinging toward giving away. Eventually, you're going to give away everything, like your sense of self. You know, that's the process to full liberation. So it makes this beautiful sense that the whole thing would begin in a very simple way with material giving, how to give away material resources. So it starts with giving and then ethics, essentially giving up, doing harmful things to get more stuff or more feeling of safety or more anything. It moves into a teaching on karma, which comes out in the text as the teaching on heaven. And we talked about this. That one was fun to talk about because no one talks about that in the insight meditation scene anyway, because everyone's, you know, atheists, scientific materialist atheists, and no one will talk about heavens, but the texts are full of references to heavens. And the teaching on heavens in this early sequence, giving ethics heavens, is a teaching essentially that says, even if you don't follow the Buddha's path and you don't go for full liberation, if you do good, basically you don't harm people, you keep the precepts, and you cultivate the heart qualities, the qualities of love and compassion, kindness, generosity, you can be reborn, you will be reborn in a lovely place in the heavens. I'll talk about that a little bit tonight in a slightly different way. We talked about that, the basics of karma. You do good, you get born in better places. And of course, we talked about the challenges with reborn as a discourse right now, especially, again, in a world where so many folks are not coming to Buddhism from this kind of archaic or mythic standpoint, you know, of many births. So the challenges in kind of squaring those teachings. We talked about heavens. Last week, we talked about the fourth of the qualities in this sequence that really begins the turn toward the liberation practices themselves, which is the dangers of sensual pleasures. And we talked about essentially addiction, really, but what it is about embodied life, where we have this relationship to pleasure and pain, and the pleasure is really desirable, and the pain is really undesirable. And basically everything we do is oriented around manipulating that ecosystem in order to live in it in the most comfortable way. And the Buddha says this is doomed, ultimately. Like, you can't possibly control the system around you sufficiently to guarantee only pleasure and to guarantee no pain, right? It's impossible. And so the grasping to sensual pleasures, then, or the danger in sensual pleasures, is that they are so bewitching that we forget this wise perspective. We forget that everything comes and goes. We forget that pleasure is temporary. We forget that pain is inevitable because the pleasure is so intoxicating. And that's the danger in it. The danger isn't that it's bad or wrong or sinful And many of us have to get over old Christian or Jewish or in many ways any of the Western monotheism's ideas about the wrongness in sensual pleasures. It's not that at all. It's simply the danger in attachment to them. Pleasure turns out to be not a problem as long as you don't make it a problem. But we totally make it a problem. And so the fourth of these early kind of pointers on the path is, hey, watch out for addictions, basically. And so, and that flows right into the fifth, the topic du jour, which is the benefits then of renunciation. Again, hardly anyone in the convert scenes, the insight meditation and other convert Buddhism scenes, talks about renunciation. Partly because it's not our primary practice. In the sense of early Buddhism, it's really a practice focused on or aimed toward, in the biggest sense, toward the monastics. Or we might say, toward, here's a bit the pathway. It shows up in these early teachings, which are often given to lay people. So it goes a little bit like this. Now that you have tasted how good it is to give and not cling to material resources, and you've tasted how good it is to be kind and ethical, to not hurt others through your words, your actions, and you've reflected on the benefits that could come to you, even if you don't practice further, just based on good action, on wholesome action, the benefit of heaven, of comfortable realms, of rebirth. And then you've really contended, even with the subtle allure of heaven realms, which is the thing you get addicted to, right? The heaven realms are extremely pleasurable and long-lasting, you know, and pure in their pleasure, right? So not unlike, let's say, you know, being high on a really nice, clean, wholesome drug, if there was such a thing, that you would get reborn into a realm of like pure bliss for a very long time. But eventually, of course, you know, the drug wears off, the heaven realm wears off, the meditative state wears off, the falling in love wears off, whatever it is, its momentum declines. And then you're back in the mud. And so then you reflect on all this. You're like, oh, that's really what it's like. And you give rise to, or so what arises in you is the impulse, you know, how could I be free of this? How could I let go of this thing that's binding me, this addiction? And so this fifth basic teaching, renunciation, is both a pointing of the path, like the path is away from addictions and toward deep equanimity. Therefore, letting go is the path. So this fifth one points the path. And it also, in a certain way, is meant to inspire you, not just to think of that as the path, but actually do the actions that propel you along the path. And classically speaking, one of these would be to get ordained as a monastic, a monk or a nun. So the word renunciation points to the quality in the simplest form of letting go. Letting go in the material realm, letting go emotionally or psychologically of things that we cling to, and then letting go in a very deep lifestyle way of perpetuating the system at all by becoming celibate, by becoming intentionally poor, by living solely on the generosity of others, so not, in a sense, contributing to the economy in a perpetuating way, giving away teachings for free. Essentially unhooking very deeply from that which keeps the whole wheel of commerce going, including making children. That's the monastic end of the renunciation spectrum. But it's taught to lay people in the beginning because, in a way, like all of the Dhamma is said, the Buddha said the Dhamma is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. It's so good in the beginning would mean something like renunciation as an orientation is good, even if you're not becoming a full monastic. It's good because it's based in letting go. And letting go is the basis of a deepening tranquility and peacefulness and unboundedness in the heart. But there's some challenges with it. One is that letting go, in a certain way, requires that you have something to let go of. And that's true for everyone on the subtle, like emotional or psychological realm. But in the texts, very, very often, letting go practice, renunciation practice, giving practice, is initially directed, let's say, toward those with wealth. When we meet people of various social classes in the texts, we almost always meet the rich. The Buddha encounters princes and princesses, kings and queens, wealthy lay people who have many servants, who take care of land, who are landlords in various ways according to the time. He meets warriors, kshatriya caste folks. He meets Brahmins, priestly caste folks. He meets some well-to-do merchants. There's not as much discussion of the poor in these texts. Where are they? They totally show up. Right, he ministers to the poor and rich alike, but the teachings that are directed toward the poor, for instance, are a little bit different. Often, I don't know of a text where he emphasizes like material giving up to the poor. I know of texts where the poor become ordained, and I know of texts where the poor practice the precepts, the virtues, and are reborn in good places on account of their good actions. But what if, in a certain way, the teaching that starts with letting go is the right teaching for the wealthy, for the comfortable? Because the addiction to the comforts brought about by wealth is a huge, huge bond on the heart, right? The addiction to comfort that material resources can provide goes very, very deep. And so then the Buddha, who was raised wealthy himself, you know, has as his first insight, all this wealth, all this material resource can't save me from old age, sickness, and death. So then what good is it? He says, I seek that which won't die. And in one of the myths that starts to arise around the Buddha's enlightenment night, when he meets Mara, the force of delusion or doubt, one of the things Mara does, and this is a classic mythic encounter between the renunciate sage and a divine force that seeks to dissuade him from his path. Mara, the deceiver, the kind of semi-divine or demonic figure that seems to be like a projection essentially of the doubt faculty in the psyche, shows up and says, you know, don't bother getting enlightened. How about wealth and power? You know, how about all this, like becoming a great king, you know? And this is symbolized in part by the sensual pleasures associated with material wealth, in the form of sexual pleasure. The images that Gautama might lust after appear in his mind. Or mythically, the daughters of Mara appear, which we can now say is, you know, the heteronormative myth of the renunciate male seeker. So this arises embedded within the patriarchy of the myth, of course. And yet, it points to this piece, not just about sexuality and gender, but about power in general, and that the Buddha is offered power and the possibility that he could maintain his physical comfort as he was raised in for the rest of his life. And he rejects it, as the seeker in the myth must, because it's actually a bad bargain. It's not liberation at all. And so he turns away from wealth as the cornerstone of his teaching. But what he offers in an interesting way is a couple of different pathways. The pathway for the rich partly involves either, if you're going to stay a layperson, giving away a lot of wealth, supporting the monastics, supporting those in your community who need it, or becoming a monastic yourself. And one of the main places we meet the poor in the texts is when they become monastics. And they clearly, and this is stated both literally and in the example of the disciples, they clearly have just as much, you know, chance of becoming fully liberated as as the wealthy do. One of the great things that happens if you become a monk or a nun is you lose your social class or your caste. And this was mobilized in a political way in the 20th century by the great Dalit or untouchable caste politician in India, Ambedkar, who in a very dramatic public ritual converted out of Hinduism to Buddhism with tens of thousands, the number varies depending which exaggerated account you read, but many, many, many tens of thousands of Dalit or untouchable caste followers, because doing so, even without becoming ordained, erased their caste in a legal sense in India. They became Buddhists, which meant they were outside of the Hindu caste structure, and they were suddenly able to access social services, for instance, that they couldn't from within their untouchable caste status. So this, in a way, becomes one of the most substantial gestures, a kind of radical class or resource redistribution gesture within Buddhism. It's premised on another thing, which is that there is a monastic order. If there is a monastic order, then you actually can leave home and join it. So here's a little sort of thought experiment. I know you live in the Bay Area, if you do, unless you're visiting, but I do. Many of us do. You know it's expensive here, right? I know some people who even themselves would call, you know, categorically like rich, like really wealthy, but mostly I know folks of many, many varying levels of resources who almost all, in certain ways, struggle to live here. It's an expensive place to live. And so teachings on like letting go, give a whole bunch of your income, are interesting here, partly because a lot of us, even those who are relatively comfortable, still don't have a lot of income to give, unless you were going to really lean into you know, philanthropy as a primary expense for you, and you can. And the same stories appear in the Buddhist texts as appear in the Christian texts, where a poor person who gives a very tiny amount but a large percentage of their income gains a lot of spiritual merit, as it were, because different from a rich person who gives a very tiny percentage of their income but, you know, gets puffed up about it, has pride about it. But imagine this. So you're struggling to live here. It's expensive. You've got all the challenges of ordinary life. You may have children and you may not. But you find out that just outside of town, like here we are in Berkeley, so let's just say like up in Tilden Park, or maybe a little over the back end, kind of Arinda Foothills, an easy, you know, a good day's walk maybe, but you could get there, you could walk there. But maybe a couple small bands even closer in, you know, Strawberry Park up in Codornices, nice park, I would live there. There's bands of alms mendicants, people living in intentional poverty. They're either living out under the trees or in tents. But instead of being there as victims of poverty and really struggling, they are there intentionally living an ordered, beautiful in some ways life, marked by monastic discipline, marked by communal life. And every day to eat, they walk into town, they collect one meal from whoever gives it to them, and if nothing is given, then they don't eat that day, right? If that happened a lot, they would move away, but let's say it's happening enough, they're getting enough to eat. And maybe even some people have built them, you know, decent little huts, like, you know, like a sixth the size of this room, right? Just a little hut in the forest. And they're living out there, and you can tell that their life is wholesome. They're not hurting people. They're not deceiving folks to get their alms. And you can go out there and you can hear teachings, and they have good teachers, and they're helpful to you in your life. And you get a hit that they're doing something really good out there. And you are absolutely welcome to join them. Right? What you give up is sex and money, basically. Right, and your own property, right? You go in, you adopt their lifestyle and their discipline, and you'll be taken care of. You'll get a little hut or a little tent to live in. You walk for the meal a day. You live with other people who are good people. You talk about life and feelings and how to be free, you practice. You live in the beautiful wilderness with the deer and the mountain lions, and you have a very simple life on this earth. Imagine for a moment that that's there, that those folks are there. They're right there, they're walking distance, and there's thousands of them, not just a few, but like many, many different groups of them, numerous, whole communities to join. What would that feel like to have those people right there living like that? And then to know that there's an open door, that you can go at any moment and join them and do that for the rest of your life, or for a period of years, or whatever felt right. And you would be cared for. You would get what are known as the requisites: food, shelter, medicine, clothing. Just enough to live by. Would that change your feeling of scarcity or of the pressures of being here? Even if your life was still stressful to make it or to support your family or whatever you were doing in your business, would it change it even to know that there was the possibility of going there? And then what if a whole bunch of people who were poor or really struggling here went there and did that? What if those communities were full of folks who were, for various reasons, not making it in commercial life down here, in the flats, in the business part of town, who could choose at any moment to go there, and you would get an education, you would learn to read, you know, or learn the systems, and be cared for? What I'm pointing at, in a way, is that, like, renunciation is this utter cornerstone to this practice, but I think that cornerstone rests on a ground of a social kind of structure or culture that we don't have. When I really connected to the fact that I could go and be a monk and be taken care of, but to do so I'd have to go to Asia, to go to one of the heritage Buddhist countries, most likely. There's places here you can do it, but it's harder to get into. It's harder to do. It's more expensive to do here. But that I didn't have this access to a clear, what I came to call the monastic option, I felt a very particular grief in myself that I could sense that in some ways the Buddhist path was premised on the promise that if you're willing to live simply like this, you don't have to struggle for material well-being anymore. You can actually step out of the game and be cared for in a very simple level. I want to make a parallel somehow to like universal basic income, right? Like, let's just say even in the absence of monasticism, if you were guaranteed warm clothing, a tiny hut, medicine, and one meal a day, in a very simple lifestyle, but you can't own any of it, but we'll give it to you, would you take it? Would you take that bargain? Especially if that lifestyle was embedded not just in that material way of living, but was embedded in this whole system of spiritual practice. So, of course, as Buddhism developed, other systems grew up that weren't as austere as the early system, that were oriented more toward lay people. And in the orientation toward lay people, other teachings came around. Within the heading of the Mahayana, or the schools known as the Mahayana, other teachings arose that, for instance, you might take as an example the Pure Land schools. That are most numerous, say in China and Japan. That took as their ideal not the individual becoming liberated through a kind of ascetic or deep letting go liberatory practice as a monk or a nun, but took as their ideal the practitioner who is devoted in a kind of heartfelt, prayerful way to a bodhisattva or a personification of absolute reality. And then through that devotion, one might be born in a pure land, like a heaven realm, devoted to this particular Buddha and or bodhisattva. And from there, the power of that Buddha or bodhisattva would uplift your liberation process. It starts to sound a lot like Christ in heaven, right? At least to some of us who come from Christian traditions, when I hear, you know, you don't have the power to save yourself necessarily, but if you believe in this radiant figure, cosmic figure, you can be reborn in a blissful realm pervaded by this one presence, and through devotion to that, through the power of that being who is so much stronger than you, vaster than you, your suffering would be released. You would attain the end of the path in a way that you can't by yourself. This starts to sound like salvation, and it is to my wondering, I wonder if it's not random that these kind of devotional interpretations of Buddhism, when those paths came to the West, immediately got much more purchase in the working classes. So like up at Spirit Rock, that some of us joke might be called the upper middle way, right? Very comfortable center, right? We've been struggling with, let's say, diversity for 20, 30 years with, you know, well-meaning white folks wringing their hands about why there aren't more brown folks in the Sangha. But if you're actually like, well, where are the brown folks in American convert Buddhisms? You find them, for instance, you know, at the Pure Land centers. You know, you find them at Soko Gakkai, chanting Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Very, very diverse, very working class community. Why? And I have a guess that the forms of Buddhism that emphasize letting go at their heart are in a certain way more attuned to or more appropriate for the middle and upper classes, because they actually have something to let go of. Whereas for poverty and working classes, the way that the Dharma often is interpreted is in relation to things like, you know, self-care or healing or coming out of trauma or, you know, undoing systemic oppressions or in other traditions, you know, devotional practices, prayer practices, celebration practices. What if for folks without material wealth, letting go is not actually the right first teaching, but uplift is the right first teaching? Uplift from systems of oppression that are material and social. And that in the absence of a monastic structure that could enfold folks from any social class, but could scoop in folks and provide the material basis for the traumatized nervous system to calm and settle and heal. In the absence of that, renunciation, I think, becomes a charged teaching that that feels different depending on who's hearing it. So I think as we go on with this topic, next week, this is the end of that formal first kind of set of five things. Next week, we'll stick with renunciation a little bit. We'll talk about the four requisites themselves, food, shelter, clothing, and medicine, and how, in a way, if we think about the nervous system and trauma, if part of what trauma is doing is creating the feeling of constant emergency, before we can do anything oriented toward letting go or tranquility or joy, we have to come out of the state of perceived emergency. So trauma has to be healed, which really means uplifted into the feeling of safety, before, in a sense, anything else can happen. That's our biology. If it still thinks there's an emergency, it can't really attend anything else. You could be at the most beautiful art performance, but if you think you're being attacked, you can't see the beauty. So trauma needs to actually be uplifted into health before anything further, and particularly anything that lets go of pleasure, I think should even be attempted. The first task is this basic uplift. And I'll propose that if the monastic system were extant, if it actually existed here, joining the monastic system would be a way to uplift out of the emergency mode of trauma and scarcity, because you can simply join the system and stay. This is in a certain way very personal for me. I come from a comfortable middle class background, but I crashed out of it into all sorts of failure in my early 20s, still in a way that was very privileged, and I was never in deep danger, but I was probably quite depressed and lost. And when I ended up living at this Zen monastery in New Mexico, my first long, kind of many-month stint at a center, I had been there for a few months, and I noticed something that had never really crossed my mind before, but that I noticed that something was shifting in me when I realized that at any point in my life, really, unless I was really couldn't work at all, like if I was really, you know, bedbound or something, but if I could do almost anything to contribute to the community, at any point in my life, I could just go to this place or a place like it. Once I figured out that there were places like this, I could go there and they would just take me in without any resources at all, that I wouldn't have to pay my rent to be there. And when I realized this, I noticed that something in me let go. That was a kind of fear, and it was a fear of failing, really, in modern consumer life. Like, that I would just, like, I wouldn't be able to make it in the world of jobs and money and productivity. I would end up, like, the only option I had ever seen for not making it was ending up kind of destitute on the street. And I realized that barring a few extreme things that would make it not possible for me to be at a center like this, like extreme illness or addiction, I could go to a place like this and they would catch me. There was a safety net. And until I realized that, I had been resting in the fear of there being no safety net. So I'll propose that the monastic system is a safety net, and that it is a necessary component of a healthy, let's say, Buddhist ecosystem in a culture, because it's the thing that will catch you, or could catch you, if for whatever reason it's right for you to turn away from the commercial system. So then renunciation is both core practice, refuge, and a completely different thing for folks who come from resource and for those who come from lack of resource. Any thoughts here on this, or anything that came as you were reflecting on what it might feel like if there were monastics nearby?
It's occurred to me a lot that because it feels like there's not a safety net or a disappearing safety net in our culture, there's a sort of a frantic clinging and hoarding, because what if you become incapacitated?
Yeah.
And so I so appreciate what you're saying. I know about Alokavihara, and it's a great comfort because I've been on enough retreats to know that this would be something that I would embrace, you know. So it makes a big difference to me that it exists.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when we think about dwindling social safety nets and the monasticism as a certain safety net, you know, one of the places this goes for me, I've talked about this before, maybe we can get into this later this year, we'll do a little economics series or something, but I think that this points toward a certain kind of, you know, spiritually oriented or ethically oriented socialism, ultimately. Yeah.
Hey.
Hey.
My name's Alan. Sorry, I didn't introduce myself before.
No worries.
Is the intent for renunciation itself a problematic of renunciation? And, like, within that kind of setup of problematic of renunciation, how can you enter that kind of spiritual community?
Yeah.
As a living safety net without entering it unintentionally? And is it ironic that you almost describe the monastic life in terms of, you know, the plethora of communities around the Bay Area that actually do live at the fringes of the city and actually are, to my knowledge, extremely welcoming, should you enter into that safety net of perhaps a greater karmic resonance rather than one of material safety?
Yes, yes. It would be very interesting, would it not, if, let's say, a whole bunch of wealthy folks gave away all their wealth and with only a backpack, you know, a couple changes of clothes, a very simple tent, nothing worth stealing, you know, set up a small intentional community in a vacant lot in exactly the way that folks are forced to through poverty here. First of all, like, would society at large feel like that was a different thing if it was, like, intentionally, if it was clear that it was intentionally chosen versus, you know, this is a homeless encampment that in a certain way is not intentionally chosen. You know, what would it be like if rich folks with patrons, like willing to support them, came in and said, we want to live in this homeless encampment with the homeless folks, but, you know, we'll take care of the sanitation and get people to clean it up and make it legal for the city. Like, could wealth be used in a certain way to make those communities safer without demonizing them? In a way, part of what you're asking, at least for me, speaks to the kind of the impossibility, really, of talking about renunciation as a wholesome, material renunciation as a wholesome available choice here, because you know, like, land use and property and economics and culture in a certain way, like, we don't live in a generous culture, has made it impossible for those communities to thrive. Like Lisa mentioned Alokavihara, which is one of our local monastic centers. There's three nuns living there. And it takes quite a bit of resources to support three nuns in the wilderness. And by quite a bit, I mean quite a bit in a culture that doesn't give very much away. You know?
Are these communities not thriving? You know, like, look around the Bay Area. There's so many communities that of people who have actually unintentionally renunciated.
Right.
You know, and who is, I mean, are they not thriving?
We would have to go to and ask if they're thriving. And I would suspect that when you say unintentional, tell me what you mean by that.
Right. Or perhaps with, like, a confusion of intent and non-intent. I mean, maybe somebody might have an intent to do ABC over the course of 10 years, but at the end of the course of 10 years, they end up living in a tent on the side, you know, the highway or the hill. You know what I'm saying?
Basically, I think I know what you're saying. What I don't want to do is confuse, you know, homelessness with monasticism. It's the interesting thing is simply how similar the two lifestyles could look, but in every other aspect, they're radically different. For instance, you know, in the Buddhist texts, when people come and they come into some park, and the Buddha's followers are there practicing, what folks remark on is how peaceful it is. It's clean, it's quiet, the people are walking back and forth beneath the trees or tidying up, they're in silence. There's a deep, like, tranquility in these communities where folks are living. Or the monks themselves say, you know, we live in silence together, peacefully blending like milk and water. When there's a task to do, one of us does it. We are generous with each other. Like, there's all these good qualities. You could find all these qualities in an encampment, for sure. Like, they're organized, people are taking care of things, it's all true. Where it differs, I think, is in the adoption of a unified framework of action, like the monastic order, right? So it's not just people living there, but you have to observe all these rules, you know, and extremely precise rules of conduct. And if those rules fluctuate in a certain way, the community doesn't cohere as well. You know, let's say one of the big monastic rules is to not eat past the noon hour. Right? If some of the people there are observing that practice and others are not, it makes confusion at 5 o'clock. Who's doing what? Right? How do we know who we are, in a sense? So the monastic order is not just a way of living, but it's an extremely structured way of living. And so part of what is, you know, what I'm pointing to and what you're pointing to in, like, the problematic of it is something like, for me, could those kind of communities be a safety net? What would it take for them to be that? And I think what it would take is, you know, safety and structure in a certain way, so that you would really know if you were going to go join the folks living at this place, what you would get would be this kind of thing. You know, you would get, you know, mass every morning at 7 a.m., or you would get meditation at these times and work at these times. And, you know, you would join the community particular to the kind of teaching you loved also. You'd be like, oh, I'm going to join the Buddhist community or the Jain community or the Ajivikas or the whoever's. So yeah, I don't know if that speaks clearly to what you're suggesting, but I think it would feel differently if it was clear that communities of folks living on the margins were socially respected, really, and cared for by the larger public, rather than socially disrespected and reviled, you know, not cared for. Yeah.
In my own brain, filter through your experience. So
yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about what love is, and I often think about what trauma is.
Yeah, what love is, what trauma is, yeah.
Being work. And I wonder, as you explain this experience of realizing that, you know, the space you were in, that, like, unclenching, that moment of realization, my mind thought, oh, Sean might have been experiencing, like, unconditional love. Like, there is safety mm-hmm. for you. And as you think about, like, trauma and what heals trauma,
yeah,
you don't have to worry. No matter what, you're going to be okay. No matter
yeah.
what, you're accepted in this
yeah.
space. And how healing that might be. If people who are experiencing trauma, who haven't experienced what, you know, what would be unconditional love? Having
sure
structure,
yep.
you know, you have a kid,
yep.
you want them structured, this is what's expected, and
yep.
here's how you can feel safe, and you don't have to worry. It's going to
yeah.
be okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you say that that's, was this something
sure.
you
You know, if the feeling of, you know, if ordinary grasping is like grasping to sense experiences, like the sensual experience of feeling warm or safe or comfortable, that kind of thing. On the emotional level, that could be like the sensory experience of feeling love from someone, you know, like a parental figure, say. And so when the parental figure or the therapist can provide, you know, unconditional positive regard, that has the potential, hopefully, of hitting that spot in the heart that always felt like love was a commodity that was scarce, right? I had to do the right thing. I had to be the right kind of person. I had to be a good child or a silent child or a brilliant child or a whatever, right, to receive love and acceptance. Once you get that, like, oh, that's available no matter who you are, something might get to soften, right? Something that was vigilant, right, or trying to maintain a position would get to soften. So absolutely, I think you're right in the making the parallel that, like, the habitual situation is that the heart thinks that it has to clench in order to have. And the liberated situation is that the heart knows that it doesn't have to clench. And I think what I'm proposing around, like, the material is that in the absence of a safety net of any kind, it's very difficult for folks experiencing a lot of material suffering to achieve the unclenching in relation to that, because trauma and scarcity is too loud in the system. And so that would be true for the emotionally traumatized as well, right? Until we can feel like, oh, refuge has me, right? Refuge is the emotional side of the monastic order. It's like once you've taken refuge, you can fail at business and, you know, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha has still got you. Right? I said to one of my teachers several years ago in a mentoring conversation, this was Gil Fronsdahl, I said, I really have doubt often if I can make it in the, like, kind of commercial, like, business world. It's so fierce. And I only have a few skills, and two of them are music and meditation, and neither of those pay. And he said, just stay close to the Sangha, and it will take care of you. And that was a very classical, very old-fashioned thing to say, you know. And in a certain way, like, has a beautiful faith in it, that even in the absence of the monastic order, stay close to the Sangha, and it'll be okay, is what he was saying. You know, very much that, like, the heart can unclench. So maybe in closing, I'll say that what if one of the things we could work toward was communities of practitioners, whether monastic or not, like whatever our culture can sustain, but communities that would be strong enough to be able to actually say to someone, we've got you, you know, rely on this structure and we're going to care for each other. And that in a way would be like the basis of both a ground that the wealthy could land into coming out of the delusions of privilege, but also a ground that the wounded could be held and uplifted in and brought into more power that was denied by other structures. So we'll go on from there. Buddhist socialism is on the horizon in this direction. We'll talk more about that. Maybe later this year we'll do a little bit on the beautiful Thai reformer, Ajahn Buddhadasa, who wrote a book on Dharma socialism. But the more in the immediate future, starting the beginning of March, I've been really loving and learning so much from one of the most brilliant scholar monastics we have around right now, Bhikkhu Anālayo, a German monk ordained in the Sri Lankan tradition. And I've been practicing with his instructions for satipatthana, or mindfulness practice, based in the body. So for March and April, we're going to do an 8-week series on kind of details of meditation practice based in this satipatthana system and based in his book, the practice guide to satipatthana. So in here, we'll start that in a couple weeks, beginning of March. I'll promo it in a kind of lame way online, as I usually do. but it'll happen. And that's exciting. So I'll say more about that next week and as it comes closer, and someday I will manage things online that will let you know more about what's happening here. But thanks for being here anyway. And I'm looking forward to it. So blessings for your practice. I'll see you next week or anytime.